Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 1:07 PM, that is Pacific Summer Time. Today is May 6th. And I thought we'd kick off today with the totals for central banks' balance sheets. When I first created this chart back in 2014, I'm pretty sure that I was the only person looking at it. But since then, it's really become very popular. And certainly, we can look at what happened in 2018, because there was a significant medium-term peak, and the total assets of central banks declined steadily, although modestly, between the beginning of 2018 and all the way through until about the middle of 2019. And since then, it's risen by almost $4 trillion. Now, there has been a lockstep manner in which the stock markets have been rallying in conjunction with the total assets of central banks. And if we overlay the two charts, well, then we get a pretty good idea of what's happened. We can also see that the S&P 500's trend became considerably more volatile after the peak in 2018. That's, I think, one of the most important points, that capital is both mobile and global. When central banks in one part of the world issue currency, then it's picked up by investors and transported to the regions or asset classes that offer the most attractive return. And that's something that's going to happen regardless of how much liquidity there is. But how well the strategy pays off is going to be dictated by how much liquidity there is. And the continued upward trend that we saw in the S&P 500 until 2018 was fueled by economic expansion, continued outperformance of large caps, and all of that was predicated on the availability of liquidity to fund their operations. Now, one of the issues, of course, is that we've had much more volatility over the last 18 months to 2 years, and that's particularly true over the last 2 months. And the consumer has taken a significant hit. Now, consumers are not nearly as leveraged today as they were back in 2006 and 2007, but corporations are. Corporations are much more leveraged today than they were back then. And now the big question is, to what extent is the continued supply of liquidity, a 20% increase in the balance sheet, the size of global central bank balance sheets in the space of 2 months, has bought a significant rebound in stock markets. But unlike the period between, for example, early 2016 and early 2018, corporations are not as healthy today as they were then, and the consumer is not as healthy as it was then. There are significant uncertainties about how economies are going to open up, when they are going to open up, how eager are consumers going to be to get back to their same pattern of spending, how able will consumers be to get back to their previous pattern of spending, and how many businesses are going to open up. All of these are massive uncertainties. The stock market would appear to be ignoring them from the perspective of the companies that have benefited most from the provision of liquidity. And I do think that companies like Tesla and Netflix are among the most significant in this regard. Tesla has rebounded from $400 to about $800, so a handy double in the space of little more than 7 weeks. Now, even the CEO of the company is saying that the shares are overvalued. I think it's quite likely that, considering the pace of construction that the company is embarking on, that we're in for another lengthy ranging phase. But the other point, of course, is that Tesla isn't really about making cars. It's about regulatory arbitrage. And their ability to continue to expand their production capacity is really aimed at capturing as much of the carbon credit market as they possibly can. That's where or at least that is the arbiter between whether they make money or not. Then when we think about Netflix, they have been able to borrow money at incredibly attractive rates, and they have used that to spend extraordinary amounts of money on producing mediocre programming, but they've been able to sell it to millions and millions of people, and that has also sustained the share. Now, these are the kinds of companies that benefit from massive availability of liquidity. And they have, to a greater or lesser extent, been able to sidestep the weakness in the wider economy or in the real economy simply by virtue of the fact that their operations are, in many respects, virtual. Accessing carbon credits for Tesla is going to happen one way or another because of their manufacturing capacity. How many cars they produce is going to be influenced more by how much money they can make off of carbon credits and getting other companies that are competing with them to fund their operations. That's something that's going to happen. That at least gives them a cushion of security. But of course, it also highlights the contradiction in the market. These kinds of contradictions that companies that are a long way from making money on a sustained basis and rely on cannibalizing their competition. This is the kind of it's the kind of business model that Blofeld from 007 or from James Bond movies or Lex Luthor from DC Comics and Superman would come up with, and yet this is exactly what we have in the real world today. There are, of course, the kinds of companies that have been benefiting enormously from the provision of liquidity. Apple continues to rebound. And when we look at the longer-term chart, then we have this series of ranges, one above another. And every time it has pulled back, it has found support in the region of the upper side of the underlying range. And it's done that again. Microsoft is another company that is benefiting from the evolution of the cloud, and the share is coming back into the region of the all-time peak. I think it's a bit of a big ask to think that the Nasdaq is going to exceed the 10,000 point level on its first attempt. And the market was certainly in positive territory in here today. And technology generally is offering a clear relative strength, and not least because of the massive availability of liquidity and the likelihood of continued availability. However, when we then start to look at companies that have got more real-world applications, then the Dow Jones, for example, has unwound about half of its decline. It's still trading below the 200-day moving average, but it is right in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. This is a key area that it needs to sustain a move above, and more particularly, it needs to push back above the 200-day moving average. But there is a short-term overbought condition. It's as plain as day. We don't need indicators to tell us that. And it's quite likely that we're going to have a period of some consolidation at the bare minimum in order to justify the potential for additional upside. And the transportation index hasn't even unwound half of its decline. It has an overhead type 3 top formation. And this isn't the kind of top formation that a sector recovers from immediately. And obviously, the epicenter of risk right now is in the transportation sector from the perspective of leisure and business. It's also the transportation sector is being heavily impacted by less demand for commodities, less demand for imported or exported goods, and less demand for oil. So there is obviously then the clear potential that it is going to take a significant period of time for transportation to recover. And what this is clearly pointing to is a really very large dispersion between the winners and losers. So we have got a relatively small number of winners, whether that is going to be in the mega cap technology sector, in the semiconductors industry, where the semiconductors index is back above its 200-day moving average. The biotech industry is perhaps one that has got ample scope to turn to outperformance. I think there is the clear potential that when we think about the biotech sector, where it has gone sideways for nearly 5 years, there is a clear potential that over the course of the next couple of years, that the permissioning process for new drugs, and particularly for genetic drugs or genetic solutions, is going to be significantly streamlined. If we have a globally significant life-saving solution delivered in record time to tackle the coronavirus, either in the form of providing immunotherapy or providing a genetic solution to destroy the coronavirus, then that is going to be a perfect commercial use case to really highlight the fact that genetic solutions are not somewhere off in the future, but that are in fact real time, and that the breakneck speed with which they can be delivered relative to the slow pace of permissioning that has prevailed in the pharmaceutical sector for decades is a true game changer. It massively reduces the cost of bringing new solutions to market. One of the clearest issues with the biotech sector over the course of the last decade has been the focus on rare diseases. And the reason that they focused on rare diseases was to try and build up the efficacy and the data to prove that genetic solutions work, because they could get necessary and orphaned drug permissioning. The big arena for biotechnology is in chronic conditions, but that's also where pharmaceutical companies make the vast majority of their money. The difference is that biotechnology can provide cures rather than treatments, and that completely upends the business model for the global pharmaceutical sector. Pharmaceuticals have also been among the biggest and most reliable dividend payers over the course of decades. And if the permissioning process for the biotech sector is streamlined, then it represents an existential threat to the conventional pharmaceutical sector in terms of their business models. So the cost of developing new solutions and the accessibility of gene editing technology is something that is going to profoundly change the healthcare sector over the course of the next decade. And of course, that is something that is likely to be a really quite positive outcome from the coronavirus. Now, when we think about, well, what are the eventual repercussions going to be from all of this money printing? It's likely that we're in the early stages of an inflationary cycle. But the obvious solutions to inflation and to massive deficits, which would be to either find wealth taxes or immovable objects to tax, such as property, or to raise corporation taxes or raise income taxes. These are going to be very difficult and politically sensitive areas to tackle, and there's not going to be much appetite from politicians to do these kinds of things until there is clear evidence of inflation that is undeniable from a institutional perspective. The dog in the street knows that we've had inflation over the course of the last 20 years. Education and healthcare and insurance, have all surged in price. We've also seen that energy prices have increased and regulatory costs have inflated significantly over the course of the last couple of decades. So to think that there hasn't been inflation from a retail investor's perspective is risible, but that's irrelevant when we look at what at the statistics that the Federal Reserve used to justify their actions. They're not worried about debt monetization at present, because they don't see the kind of wage demand growth and higher money creation in the banking sector that created inflation back in the 1970s. But one of the biggest takeaways from all of the money that has been given away in response to the coronavirus is likely to be that wage earners are going to demand higher wages. The fact that unemployed people can now make more than people who are still lucky enough to have a job is an incredible contradiction. There is no incentive to try and hold on to your job. Most people would prefer to be unemployed until at least July. And even after that, we're in an election year. There's the potential that these kinds of extremely generous unemployment benefits are going to be extended. Eventually, there's going to be a groundswell of demand for higher wages, that if people are going to be encouraged back into the workforce, then they're going to demand higher wages. And that is where inflation begins. If people start to get more money and they start to spend that money, then the velocity of money will start to pick up. It's at that point then that central banks will have to start to raise interest rates or retard the massive expansion of liquidity, or governments will have to start to withdraw some of their stimulus. The challenge in all of this is that rest of populations have zero tolerance for austerity any longer, and it suggests that we are going to be moving into more of an inflationary oriented environment. Now, when we think about that from the perspective of a bond investor, then treasury yields are still holding around the 50 basis points. The yield on UK gilts has also stabilized, and it's still holding in positive territory around the 20 basis point level, but all of the German yield curve is now in negative territory. So that's also a contradiction in terms. Now, there is still this big question about how long is it going to take for the Eurozone to come to the realization that the creation of pan-European entities supersedes the supreme courts of the constituent members of the EU. That's obviously going to be an area of contention for a large number of people. But one thing that we can say for sure is that we have had a massive move on the upside in the latter half of the first quarter in the 30-year German yield, and it does now look to be finding support at a higher level. Now, if the yield can sustain a move back above zero and break the sequence of lower rally highs over the course of more than 2 years, well, then we can start thinking about the potential that the yield is going to start rising from here. One thing that is also worth reminding ourselves of is that the spread for peripheral bonds over bunds is still rising. And the ECB, regardless of what the German Constitutional Court is saying, has got clear rationale for acting on the behalf of the entire Eurozone and buying bonds. They have got a clear legal rationale to say that it is completely necessary. And that means that there's going to be a significant monetary response from the Eurozone. and probably well in excess of what we've seen already, which is a good reason for why the euro should be weaker in here. And there's still a lot of uncertainty about the eurozone. I think that really does make the region uninvestable. There is an incredible amount of uncertainty, and the continued demand for bunds is really only a partial hedge. The risk is that the eurozone is going to go through an extremely difficult period because it is going to have to eventually resolve its internal contradictions. And that is likely to be brought to the fore because there is the clear potential that Italy in particular is going to be in dire straits economically and is going to have to blow through its fiscal limits. And if it isn't allowed to do that, then there are going to have to be massive remittances of funds to Italy to ensure that they can sustain their economy. We are potentially now looking at the end of fiscal austerity in Europe. And if that's the case, then the project to level out the debt-to-GDP ratios for all countries in advance of monetary and fiscal union will go straight out the window. It's at that point, then, we're either going to talk about defaults, we're going to talk about massive deficits, or full cohesion, and it's going to become a polarizing issue. And between now and then, there is likely to be a great deal of volatility in Europe, and I do suspect that the UK is going to be jolly glad that they are outside of the EU when all of this happens. The pound, however, was a little weaker in here today, and it has so far failed to sustain a move back above the trend mean. I do think that there is potential here for some additional consolidation, particularly considering how rapidly it had rebounded off the lows from March. The Chinese market was in positive territory in here today. The renminbi was a bit weaker, and that is following the Golden Week holiday in here today, or ending in here today. The A-share market was in positive territory. It continues to garner support from officialdom, but it's been largely range-bound over the last year. I don't think that there is really any signal from the performance of Chinese shares that could give us any insight into exactly how the Chinese economy is doing. I do think, though, that paying attention to what's happening with Hermes International is probably a good barometer. Demand from Chinese consumers has been quite firm, but the share was down in here today. And to consider that there is a potential for it to move to a new all-time high, I think, is just too much of a reach. We have got some significant uncertainties, and I think the most likely scenario is that we're going to have some pause in consolidation. When we look at the gold price, it remains range-bound in US dollars, and it is a little overbought in just about every currency, so it's not at all beyond the bounds of possibility that we have at least some further consolidation here. But considering the quantity of money that is being printed and the clear willingness of officialdom to devalue fiat currencies, gold remains in a medium-term bull market environment. Newmont came out with its earnings in here today. It had certainly been rallying impressively in advance of those earnings, and I think it's likely we may get some consolidation. The company was saying that they anticipate that the worst effects of the coronavirus will be felt in the second quarter. The likelihood here is that we're going to get a little consolidation. But the other point, of course, is that it ranged for the better part of 3.5 years, and ranges are explosions waiting to happen. We've had the explosion on the upside, and as long as I think it is holding the $50 area, then this is still a medium-term bull market. And there is clear potential for gold miners to continue to do well in the medium term, not least because their average cost of production is significantly below $1,700, and oil prices are a very significant factor in mining profitability. And oil prices have gone in the exact opposite direction of the gold price over the course of this year. Now, we are now in the region of the sequence of lower rally highs for Brent crude, and we've had a meaningful rally over the course of the last week. I do think it's likely that we're at the low for oil prices, but the higher they go, the greater the likelihood of additional supply coming into the market. We're in a heavily supply-dominant environment. The uncertainty about the global economy is something that is likely to contain the advance in the oil price. I think we're going to see a lower-for-longer range form, and that is likely to be a meaningful tailwind for economic activity everywhere, but most particularly in the consuming countries. Now, when we think about some of the commodity-related currencies, the Brazilian real remains weak. There is political uncertainty there. Bolsonaro's popularity is waning, and they are heavily impacted by the low oil price. The Mexican peso has been considerably firmer, not least because Mexico has got a hedge for their oil price. There has certainly been a range forming there rather than a clear trend, but the dollar was firmer in here, and it does continue to hold the sequence of higher reaction lows. Also, part of the reason why the Mexican peso has been firm over the last month has been the surge in remittances from the USA, which obviously represented a long position in, or people taking out long positions as they converted their dollars into peso. Now, how long that is going to persist is really to be seen. But in order to signal more than a short-term low, we're going to have to definitely break the dollar sequence of higher reaction lows. Then, when we think about the Australian dollar, there are obvious headwinds, but also tailwinds for the dollar. For the Aussie dollar. The first, of course, is that they have managed to contain the coronavirus better than a lot of other countries. But that is the problem, that Australia is heavily dependent on exports, particularly of commodities, to lend fuel to the economic expansion. And there is not a lot of demand when the rest of the world is still dealing with the coronavirus. So we've had a meaningful rebound in the Australian dollar, but it is now just in the region of the 200-day moving average. It's unwound all of the accelerated decline. I think it is now quite likely that we're going to have some pause and consolidation. So that, I think, is probably the biggest message, that we've had meaningful moves over the course of the last 6 weeks. That has been predicated on the massive supply of global liquidity, and certainly the shares that have made best use of liquidity over the last decade were the first port of call for traders over that period of time. But it would be very unusual to see a rebound progress to new all-time highs, and particularly when sentiment is so weak and institutional investors are expressing so much fear. There's a lot of cash on the sidelines, and a lot of people are worried about putting that money to work. So there is also an argument that a lot of this rebound has been driven by retail investors. And it's usually retail investors get killed in a bear market. They're very seldom the ones that benefit most. So I think we are more than likely coming close to a near-term peak for this rebound. And how well markets respectively find support following a pullback will clearly dictate whether we're back in a medium-term demand-dominated environment if we see higher reaction lows, or there is also the risk that some of the weaker shares will move to new lows. And I think with that, I will leave you for today and wish all the best to all of you.